Welcome back to the Country House podcast. Today we've got a great subject for you, the Grand Tour. We're not talking about the Amazon Prime show with Jeremy Clarkson and those people. This is the original gap year, if you will, where young aristocrats would go on a journey of 1 to 3 years. This was popular in Europe, especially the UK, between the 16th and 18th century. But Jeff, could you introduce us to the Grand Tour and perhaps give us a bit of historical context to it?
Sure. Thanks, Ben. The Grand Tour, I guess, provided an opportunity for aristocratic young men of means to discover the cultural wonders of Europe and especially the classical wonders of Italy. So although, as you said, Ben, from the late 16th century onwards, it began to grow in popularity. It was really throughout the 18th and early 19th century that it really reached its pinnacle. And this extended journey was seen as a rite of passage for mainly young aristocratic English men of means, as I mentioned. Towards the end, some women began to embark on the Grand Tour as well, and also some more middle-class men of more limited means, as travel began to get cheaper towards the end of the Georgian and beginning of the Victorian era. So these Grand Tourists, as they were known, as well as marvelling at the artistic and architectural masterpieces of Europe, also brought back souvenirs to commemorate and display their journeys back home. And this is why the Grand Tour is such an important part of our country house history here in the UK, because so many of the great classical artworks that we see in our country houses, whether sculptures or paintings, were brought back from the Grand Tours. So an example, for example, is the Canaletto's that were brought back of his Venetian views. Many of these were commissioned by Grand Tourists following their visits to Venice. So in fact, Canaletto was later invited to Britain, and Canaletto being, of course, the great Renaissance artist. For example, at Woburn Abbey in Bedfordshire, the seat of the Duke of Bedford, there's an extraordinary collection of Canalettos, including many from London scenes, but done in Canaletto's unique style. And this was sort of bringing back not just art from the continent, but actually artists to paint in the classical style here in the UK. So it's quite interesting, the influence of the Grand Tour and how it extends to our country houses. You look at the sculpture gallery at Chatsworth, full of beautiful classical sculptures from the Renaissance and earlier, many of which were brought back by the Duke of Devonshire to fill the sculpture gallery. Likewise, there's a sculpture gallery at Petworth. Similarly, it was done to convey the wealth and the knowledge and the well-travelled nature of these owners. So I guess we can talk a little bit about the origins of the Grand Tour. I don't know what you know about the origins, Ben, but and I'll love to hear your thoughts. But as far as I'm aware, one of the earliest Grand Tourists was actually the architect Inigo Jones, who embarked on a tour of Italy in the early 17th century. So he went on a tour of Italy from 1613 to 1614 with his patron, Thomas Howard, the 14th Earl of Arundel. And during this time, Inigo Jones visited cities such as Parma, Venice, and Rome, as well as Naples, which proved the high point of his travels. And he was particularly fascinated by the Church of San Paolo Maggiore, which he described as one of the best things that I've ever seen. And what's interesting is it was this time in Italy that shaped his architectural style. So he returned from his Grand Tour in 1614, and in 1616, he was commissioned to design the Queen's House in Greenwich for Queen Anne of Denmark, the wife of King James I. And although it took a long time for this building to be completed, it was the first classical building in England, the Queen's House, and it looks very much like a Palladian villa. You've got the rusticated piano nobile, you've got the columns, the pediments, the balustrading, sculptures and urns along the roof line. You've got capitals Corinthian and Ionic capitals at the top of each of the columns, the recessed portico that is very, very much a Palladian style, which he would himself have seen. And just before I hand back to you, Ben, the expression the Grand Tour itself comes from the 17th century travel writer Richard Lascelles, who used it in his guidebook, The Voyage of Italy. And it was really by the 18th century that the Grand Tour reached its zenith. And what was interesting was, despite the Anglo-French wars, this was a time of quite relative stability in Europe, which made traveling across the continent easier. And Ben, perhaps it would be helpful to hear from you about what the route entailed and where Grand Tourists would expect to go.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Before that, I would add a comment to what you said of obviously this kind of polished off the classical education of these young men generally. But, well, preparing many of them to go into civic and government life later on, as many aristocrats of the time did. And I do find it interesting that it was seen as this kind of necessity before entering that kind of world to immerse yourself in culture and beauty and the innovations of the time, which I don't know. There's something quite charming about that in terms of those who were making policy and deciding big decisions in governance at the time, that big focus on the value of learning about other cultures and soaking yourself up in the greatest buildings and art that you could. It's, you know, I wish we had a bit more of that value today.
And that links with the fact that many of these Grand Tourists were accompanied by their tutors. So the Grand Tourists received an education that was grounded in the classics. So many of them would have read classics at an early age from tutors back at home in the UK. So they would have learnt Latin and Greek. And during their travels, often with their tutors, they would have seen the classical ruins. They would have read Latin and Greek texts. And it would have given them an opportunity to take in recent culture, such as Renaissance paintings and more contemporary artists at work. But also it would have given them an opportunity to really indulge in the stuff they had been reading about since early childhood. So it was very much an educational Grand Tour. And like you mentioned, Ben, many of them would go into government roles or political or civic roles, the judiciary or whatever, when they came back to the UK. And all of those roles have roots in both, I guess you could say, Latin and Greek ideas of politics and early democracy, but also the law is grounded in a lot of legal terms are Latin, a lot of botanical terms are Latin. All of these things would have proved very useful as part of their education, and to see it in real life, you know, there's no denying that when you study something, it's not the same as seeing it in real life. You can study a painting of Monet's water lilies as much as you like, but to see it in person is to really understand it. And in the same way for many of these young men and their tutors, it gave them the opportunity to really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. And going on to the actual journey that was undertaken, which often took a year or more, I think generally 1 to 3 years, I read. And it would, they would go from London to Dover, generally to get over to Paris, which in itself was not a very glamorous journey. I read a funny quote by a known complainer, a travel grump, Tobias Smollett, who, when he undertook this journey from London to Dover on his Grand Tour, wrote, "The chambers are in general cold and comfortless, the beds paltry, the cookery execrable, the wine poison, the attendants bad, the publicans insolent, and the bills extortion." And that was just London to Dover. And, you know, there was I hear there was a lot of whining that went on many of these Grand Tours. Funnily enough, another writer, Lawrence Stern, called him a smell fungus, which was the origin of that word, now known by some to be sort of a synonym for a grumpy traveler. So it was by no means an easy journey for many people, but they would begin in Paris after coming over, and that was where they would buy transport or rent transport, from which they would cross the Alps and enter Italy in time for important festivals like the Carnival of Venice or Holy Week in Rome. And really, Italy, especially Rome, Florence, and Venice, was a very central destination of the Grand Tour due to its, you know, rich history, artistic heritage, the ruins of ancient Rome, the Renaissance art of Florence, and Venetian culture were really big highlights. And at that point, some would go on to Vienna or Naples to visit Pompeii and Herculaneum, but those were the key parts.
It's worth saying at that point, Ben, as they crossed the Alps from France into Italy, often going from near Lyon, they would cross over the Mount Cenis Pass, and they were often carried in a chair, like a sedan chair. So the carriage couldn't go over the mountains. So they would sit in a chair with four poor young men, probably to carry them over, which is quite a thought. And as you said, Ben, once in Italy, they would visit all the main sort of great Renaissance cities: Florence, Venice, Rome, Naples. Florence, of course, is known for its Renaissance art, where travellers often sought to be admitted to private collections to study. So they would be able to study the work of the likes of Da Vinci, Raphael, and Michelangelo. Whereas Venice, as you mentioned with the carnival, was known as a party city. And that links, of course, with the other aspect of the Grand Tour, which is that it was these young 21-year-old men who had never experienced freedom and independence, and they were able to become pleasure seekers. You know, a lot of these places boasted gambling houses, there was drinking, there was partying, and in Venice with the carnival there was the masquerade of having masks and things like that. So Venice was sort of the party city where they were able to not just enjoy all that life had to offer, but also they're able to buy many souvenirs, because Venice, of course, is a merchant city. So that's where they were able to commission the likes of Canaletto or Battista Piranesi, who created these view paintings, like a photograph, you know, like we might buy a postcard of a city we visited. In for the Grand Tourists, they'll buy Canaletto or a Piranesi, which is, again, an extraordinary thought. And Venice was often followed by an extended stay in Rome, which was the other major city alongside Florence that the Grand Tourists would go to. And there they would study the ancient ruins, as well as the contemporary Baroque art and architecture. Towards the end of the Grand Tour's sort of zenith, excavations began at cities like Pompeii and Herculaneum, meaning that the Amalfi Coast became more of a destination, Naples and all along the coastline there. So Grand Tourists started to make their way down, sometimes extending their tour then to Sicily and even Greece. And then what's interesting is the return journey would often bring in the other European countries. So the return journey, especially from southern Italy or Greece, they might take a boat round and then travel through Eastern Europe. They might go through the likes of Budapest or Prague, Vienna, Dresden, Berlin. And it was, I guess, exhausting for the Grand Tourists. You know, they were traveling by coach, by carriage. The Grand Tour could, it even took up to 8 years, depending on how far and how long these Grand Tourists would spend. So most of their 20s often were spent on their Grand Tour. And they would, of course, also learn languages. They would learn French. They would learn French customs and manners. They would learn Italian and Italian customs and manners. So it really was intended to round out the classical education of these young aristocrats who had had this grounding in Greek and Latin literature. And the other thing it was important to learn about was not just the customs and the manners, but also the politics of each of these countries. So accompanied by their tutor or their guardian, they would learn about how each country was governed, the economy, the culture. Sometimes, interestingly, tutors were clergymen, because often these were the most well-rounded, classically trained scholars. So you might have a tutor who is a vicar, and you're going off partying and getting drunk in Venice, and your tutor is your ward. So you're the ward of this tutor. Your tutor's your chaperone, and he's supposed to make sure you're learning all these things, and instead you might be getting drunk and finding mistresses in Florence. It must have been quite you can imagine the stories and the tales of these young men trying to escape their chaperones and have a bit of fun. Byron, of course, being one of the great grand tourists we can talk about, who certainly wasn't well behaved.
Really? Was he?
Oh, you know the stories of Byron. Come on, Ben.
Well, not specifically of the grand tour. Regale me with some of these stories.
Okay, well, on Byron's grand tour, where do I start? I guess for Byron, he lived abroad a lot. His time in Italy wasn't really a grand tour, because, I mean, we should do a whole episode on Byron, because he's such an extraordinary aristocrat who obviously owned a beautiful country house, so it links with the podcast. But whilst he was in Venice, for example, he used to winter in Venice, and he fell in love with a young lady called Mariana Segati, in whose Venice house he was lodging. And she was soon replaced by... She was soon replaced by a 22-year-old, Margherita Cogni. And both these women were married. They couldn't read or write, but Margherita left her husband to move in with Byron. And their fighting often caused Byron to spend the night in his gondola. And when he asked her to leave the house, she threw herself into the Venetian canal, into the Grand Canal in Venice. So that's just one story of, you know, Byron's sort of playboy antics. But there are so many more. I mean, apart from all his great, you know, there was another example in Rome. He went to Rome in 1817. And on returning to Venice, when he wrote the fourth canto of Childe Harold, he sold his country house, Newstead Abbey, and wrote the first five cantos of Don Juan. And during this period, he met Countess, I don't know quite how to pronounce it, Giocioli, who found her first love in Byron, and he asked her to elope with him. And after considering migrating to Venezuela or the Cape Colony, he ended up leaving Venice for Ravenna. And in Ravenna, he was obviously living with this lady, the young Contessa. And in due course, he would leave her for someone, you know, he had an insatiable appetite, a thirst for adventure, and his experiences on his grand tour, you know, could be made into a film or books of their own. I guess they probably have, but you know, these grand tourists got up to all sorts of things. And I don't know if you have any anecdotes or stories, Ben. I've got a couple more. I've got some stories of Lord Braybrooke from Audley End, that wonderful prodigy house in sort of on the Essex Suffolk border. So Lord Braybrooke set out, this is the second Lord Braybrooke, set out on his grand tour in 1771. And initially he went to meet his sister, his father and sister, to meet his mother's Swiss family for the first time in Geneva, and then he traveled south to Rome. And what was interesting, when he went to Rome, his taste for acquiring paintings again was he had quite an appetite for acquiring paintings, including some great paintings that can be seen at Audley End House today, such as the Holy Family meeting the infant St. John the Baptist. And he came home convinced that his travels had been a benefit, and he wrote to his father from Venice in May 1773, "You're kind enough to hope that I have either gained improvement or satisfaction in this tour. I cannot flatter myself that I am one jot a cleverer fellow than when I left you. As to satisfaction, I am so far content that I've gratified very agreeably a long desire I have ever had of seeing this most interesting country." So he's a slightly more civilized grand tourist than Byron. But have you found any anecdotes or stories, Ben, on your reading up of the grand tour?
Well, as I was reflecting on it, I remember learning about the Newdigates of Warwickshire, and they've preserved in Warwickshire many of their records and journals, and some of which are from the Grand Tour. And what fascinated me, as you'll know, a large activity that was undertaken when visiting galleries and landmarks was drawing and sketching, which I found interesting. And the Newdigates have sketchbooks from their Grand Tour that are incredibly preserved if people want to go and research them. I've had a look through them. And I loved to see the evolution from the sketches that were early on in the Grand Tour versus the end. And you see a remarkable progression in the skill and capability. So you see, for some, you know, if you had a good tutor or you were behaving well and you were moved by what you were seeing rather than going off on a jolly, it really was a powerful education and increase in these cultural skills, topping it off, culminating with the Newdigates sketch of the Uffizi Gallery, which is just remarkable. And they're really charming to look at. So, you know, it was a really good visual, physical emblem or example of what was going on in the activities that were being undertaken on these Grand Tours. Now, this is the Country House podcast, and some people might be thinking, well, what's the link between the Grand Tour and the Country House? And that's a question I'd love to get to you, Jeff, especially Palladio, the influence of Palladio from these Grand Tourists as they go and visit places that he has designed. Just what impact did the Grand Tour have on the architecture, designs, and culture of the Country House?
I think it's undeniable, Ben, that the Grand Tour probably had one of the greatest influences on the English Country House over the last 500 years. And that's not necessarily because Country House owners did the Grand Tour, although probably most of them did, but because of the influence on the architecture and the art that came about as a result of Grand Tours. So I mentioned Inigo Jones and the Queen's House in Greenwich. All the great classical architects of the from the 17th century onwards were all influenced by either their own experience of the Grand Tour or architects before them who had been on the Grand Tour. So thinking of the likes of Lord Burlington, the great gentleman architect who built Chiswick House and Burlington House on Piccadilly, and you know, which is now the Royal Academy, and you know, whose estates end up being inherited by the Dukes of Devonshire. The influence of these Italian Renaissance architects, you know, the likes of Palladio and Leoni and others, is extraordinary. I mean, you look at, and what's interesting is it extends even to today. The fact is that modern classical houses that we see today from, you know, I'm talking from the great houses of Quinn and Terry, the likes of Fern Park or Kilboy House in Ireland, to even small neo-Georgian, you know, mass builds that you see in, you know, places like Poundbury or Georgian townhouses or neo-Georgian townhouses. They've all been inspired. The classical proportions, the big windows, the columns, the pediments, the pilasters, the capitals are all classical elements that stem from actually from ancient Roman Greece and then from the Renaissance and the rejuvenation of classical architecture in Italy and Greece. So I think the fact is that when you think of an English country house today, you think of a classical country house. You think of a Jane Austen style, a Chatsworth or a Lyme Park or a, you know, it might be a small Georgian rectory, you know, where, you know, Mr. Collins lives or whoever. But it's all these country houses, the stereotypical English country house is essentially an Italian Grand Tour house. And that's not to mention the interiors. So the art, many of our greatest artists were trained, you know, portraitists were trained in the Italian style. So even up to John Singer Sargent, for example, the great Edwardian portraitist who painted many of the aristocrats of the day in the pre and post First World War period, or primarily the pre First World War period. But you know, these great artists were all classically trained, sight-size artists who were trained in the manner of the great Florentine and Roman and Venetian artists. So there's so much to say about the link between the Grand Tour and the English Country House, but I think to sum up what I've said, it's really the two are inseparable. You know, it's hard to pinpoint when British architecture hit its sort of its peak, because I guess we've talked about English Baroque architecture being the epitome of British architecture because it's sort of toned down European. But even English Baroque was inspired by the European Baroque palaces. So really, you could say that it was sort of the Tudor, Elizabethan, Jacobean era that was sort of the last real English, authentically English country houses before the classical Roman and Florentine influences crept in.
Mm-hmm. And as well as that, I look as a really great example of this, how it influenced personal country house owners, is the incredible gardens at Stourhead and all of the follies that were built around there. Of course, I mean, you could go on for ages about every single one, but they really were sort of cultural capital embodied in these buildings. You have the, the grotto, which was a popular feature as seen by the designer on the Grand Tour in Italy. Grotto was a big feature of the Italian Renaissance. And if you remember, you enter the grotto and it's sort of a refuge from the sun, and you enter and there's a fountain with this beautiful sculpture. And I can't remember what the sculpture is of. It goes off my mind. But it's incredibly Italian Renaissance. And you also have the mini Pantheon, which is, you know, a direct influence of the Pantheon, obviously. And the temple of Apollo there. All of these buildings are examples and reminders, and sort of, I know if I was to go on one of these incredibly important journeys where it takes so much effort to travel and go there and be moved by these cultural buildings and experiences that I was having, I would want to remember them in like fashion, you know, by building mini versions all around me and reminding myself of those experiences and the values that they embodied and conveyed.
And Ben, just thinking about the Grand Tour from a country house perspective, apart from obviously the follies and the architecture and the collections, what are your thoughts on why the Grand Tour declined towards the end of the 19th century?
Yeah, it's a great question and it's a great discussion, because I think there were so many things going on. It's a multifaceted decline. And in some ways, you could argue that it isn't a decline. For one, there was industrialization. You know, the rise of industrialization brought about significant social and economic changes in Europe. So the emergence of this industrial capitalism shifted the focus away from the more traditional aristocratic values and lifestyles, and the new wealthy industrialists preferred different forms of leisure and travel, like seaside resorts or spas, over the difficult and timely aristocratic Grand Tour. As well as that, you have the political upheavals. You know, the 19th century witnessed a lot of these revolutions and wars, both from a principal standpoint, but also logistically. The Napoleonic Wars were happening, so travel through Europe was obviously more difficult and slightly more dangerous. And a kind of, we have to look back and remember the kind of formation of nation states and kind of that nationalist sentiment with increased borders and restrictions on movement. So you have those, and you have the emergence of the middle class on the society standpoint, and the technological advancements in travel and cultural shifts, and meaning that there was a a wider access to easier travel that made the allure of travel as a status symbol lesser. And I guess the last point I would make on that is the trend of romanticism, right, and informality during that period, meaning that there was less of an attraction generally to visiting these urban places, you know, despite the history and things, people were looking for more of a natural getaway, be it one with nature and the pastoral. So what are your thoughts on that, Jeff? I've given a whirlwind of lots of different
aspects. Ben, that's helpful. I'd like to go back in a minute to the link between the country house and the Grand Tour, and we can finish with that, because I think that's a nice way to sum up our podcast. But I think regarding the decline of the Grand Tour, I think part of it was also a waning interest in the classical, in classical antiquities and classicism, full stop. So we had the Age of the Enlightenment and the interest in science. And so people were interested in traveling through new methods. You know, suddenly you could go further abroad. You could go to the New World. You could go to America. You could go to China. You could go to, you know, with the growth of the British Empire, it made it much easier for Britons to travel much further than simply Europe. So apart from, like you said, the ease of travel making the status symbol become less important and things like that, also and the danger involved in traveling through Europe during revolutionary times. That's not to mention, of course, that's not to say that it wasn't unsafe or wasn't safe before, because there were highwaymen who knew that these grand tourists were wealthy throughout the entire period of the Grand Tour. A lot of these grand tourists were victims of highwaymen, and that's why they wouldn't often take their souvenirs back with them. I mean, it would have been hard to carry a whole load of statues and paintings back with you in your carriage, but they would have been shipped over. And that links with the fact that even during the Grand Tour period, there were a lot of expats who lived in these cities. The British consul in Venice, for example, lived in a palazzo on the Grand Canal, and he sort of held court for all the grand tourists who would come and go, and arranged and helped to arrange the shipping of their paintings and sculptures back to England. So the waning interest, you know, as with the interest in science growing in the Victorian period and interest in the classics dwindling, that's part of the reason. But just going back, Ben, to the link between the Grand Tour and the country house, I think I've been thinking about it whilst you were talking, and I think the Grand Tour is so deeply rooted in the social and cultural history of England, because the English country house was essentially a museum or a gallery in its own right. They were not only houses, as we said, but also symbols of wealth, power, and status. And they were passed down through generations. So your collection would go into your house, and often houses were built around their collections. So you're thinking of people like Lord Burlington. He created Chiswick House almost as a gallery. It wasn't really built to be lived in. He created it as a gallery to display his antiquities that he had brought back from his Grand Tour. But I think the key elements of the key links between the English country house and the Grand Tour are, I think there are four key points. So there's the cultural influence that the Grand Tour exposed English aristocrats to the art and architecture and culture of Europe, and particularly the classical heritage of Greece and Rome. And on their return, these young men sought to emulate these cultural ideas in the design and decoration of their country houses. Hence the classical motifs, the classical architectural styles and artistic elements and embellishments on English country houses. Secondly, I think you have the collector's mentality. So many of these grand tourists collected all these art and antiquities and cultural artifacts and extended and expanded their country houses, like I mentioned, to house these artifacts and create essentially mini grand tours for anyone who visited their house. You could visit a house and get a taste of what it was like to be in Florence or Rome or Venice without visiting. The architectural inspiration, of course, I've mentioned already. So the influence of Palladio, amongst others, and also the landscape gardens. So the likes of Versailles or the great villas of the Veneto or Tuscany, influenced English gardens, as you mentioned, at Stourhead and Stowe, amongst others. And finally, there was the social prestige. So the Grand Tour was a marker of social status and refinement, as was owning a country house. And so the Grand Tour enabled them to bring together their two things. It enabled them to show their wealth and their status through their travels. So I think, to summarize, the country house and the Grand Tour are intricately connected, and the Grand Tour has shaped the cultural, artistic, architectural and social landscape of, I guess, what you could say is the heyday of British aristocracy, because it was only really, you know, in the Victorian period, we've mentioned this in past episodes, the rise of new money, the industrial class, who built some great country houses. But the heyday of English aristocracy, in the sense of the old aristocracy, was probably in the late Georgian period. And that was when the Grand Tour was at its peak. And that's when country houses were at their peak, you could argue. They were overexpanded and estates were broken up. So, you know, we've talked about this before, but all the Victorian houses that were built in the latter half of the 19th century, sometimes, yes, they replaced demolished classical or Georgian houses, but equally they were built on new estates that were created as large estates were carved up. So whereas a great house in England may have had a 50,000 acre estate in its Georgian heyday, it might have been split up into two 25,000 acre estates with a new Victorian house built on it in the latter half of the 19th century. So I guess, yeah, the heyday of the aristocracy, of the country house, and of the role of the country house in society was really during the peak of the Grand Tour.
It just shows when you look at the results of the Grand Tour on culture, society, especially in a period we look back on with such fondness, there's clearly value and wisdom in sacrificing to immerse yourself and experience the great cultures or the best of other cultures even today. So I know I love doing that. I'm off to Barcelona soon to explore Gaudi's architecture. I remember my first time in Rome. It was I'll never forget that experience. Visiting Athens, there really is something enriching and edifying about that. I know it still happens today in small amounts. You know, it's not this kind of set gap year kind of expedition, but it's happening all the time in smaller ways. And still plenty of artists I know and architects will go and for those same reasons, to soak it up and be inspired. I know of an artist, Andrew Bono, who went on tour of Italy, drawing and sketching and just soaking it up. And he did a great interview on YouTube about his experience there. So it's still happening today and it's still impacting our culture. So a fascinating topic. Thanks, Jeff, as always. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.